What's the most exciting announcement at this year's IBM Tech Exchange? Kate Soule is a program director at IBM Research. Kate, welcome. What do you think?
The Apache 2 license of Granite 3.0.
Kush Varshney, IBM fellow.
Granite Guardian.
And joining us for the very first time, Petros Zerfos, who's a principal research scientist at IBM Research.
That's an easy one. That's the high-performance Granite 3.0.
Terrific. All that and more on today's Mixture of Experts. I'm Tim Huang, and it's Friday again, which means it's time again to take a whirlwind tour of the biggest stories moving artificial intelligence this week. We'll talk about NVIDIA's latest and greatest open source model, Perplexity raising at a wild evaluation. But first, we're going to talk about IBM's annual Tech Exchange conference. There's a slew of announcements out of IBM, and we've got the ideal team to talk about what's launching this week. The first headline that I want to really address is that Granite 3.0 is out. And Kate, I know you played a really big role in getting that all together and being a big part of the launch. Tell us about what's exciting and different here from the previous generations of Granite.
Thanks, Tim. So we're really excited about Granite 3.0. It launched at like 12:15 a.m. on Monday morning. And
you know, down to the minute.
I know, down to the minute. And the reception's been really, really phenomenal. So Granite 3.0 is IBM's state-of-the-art large language model family. They're a series of models that cover language models, safety models called Granite Guardian. We even have some models focused around efficiency, like a speculative decoder model that came out, and they're all available under Apache 2.0 license, which is really exciting.
Yeah, and I would say, is there kind of a deeper theme that IBM's kind of pushing with this set of releases? It almost feels like every generation of Granite's getting kind of broader and broader, and there's like more and more things launching with each generation. But I'm curious if the team had any particular thing that they were kind of emphasizing on this round.
Well, with this round, our main goal was to actually consolidate all the different things into one model. So where before IBM had English language models, multilingual models, code models in our previous generations, generations one and two, with generation three, we're able to bring all of that into one model while continuing to push the boundaries of how much performance can you pack into, you know, an 8 billion parameter model.
Nice. So I really want to get into the details here because we have an ideal configuration, which is, Kate, you and Kush and Petros were all involved in the Granite sort of release, and we'd love to kind of dig more into the details. Petros, I think maybe I'll throw it over to you because you name-checked that the most exciting thing at Tech Exchange this year was Granite, which you worked on. Do you want to tell us a little bit about your involvement with the release and what's got you most excited about it?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, as I mentioned, it's a very exciting release. My involvement is around the data engineering, essentially the preparation of the huge amounts of data that goes into the training of such kind of large language models, all the way from the acquisition to the point where it's converted into their vectorized form, which is called tokens. And this is essentially what's used for the training of Granite models. It's billions of documents, lots of terabytes and petabytes worth of data. Massive infrastructures thrown behind it. Very exciting.
Yeah, for sure. And I really want to get into that because I think so often, you know, particularly at these tech conferences or even, you know, just in general, people always see the end result, right? They say, look at these cool new models I can use. And, you know, as someone who's a consumer of these models, obviously, I'm personally very excited. But I think what's so exciting about your work and the opportunity of having you on the show today is to kind of talk a little bit about what goes on behind the scenes. And that data curation, tell us what's like, what is hard about it, right? Like what makes it a really hard challenge?
Right. That's a very good question. What makes it a very hard challenge is a multitude actually of things, many challenges. First of all, the sheer volume of data that is needed in order to essentially be curated and be fed in some sense into the training process is breathtaking. We're starting with literally petabytes of raw data and collected from a number of sources, including the whole internet itself. And then the curation process and the subsequent steps of annotation and filtering towards essentially finding the golden nuggets of very high quality data that will go into the training. It's a massively kind of challenging process. Lots and lots of machines and clusters and data centers, if I may say, are needed in order to go through such kind of cleansing and filtering.
Yeah. Were there any particular documents that you were like, oh man, this is in here? Or like, I'm kind of curious about like if there's any surprises in the process where you're like, oh, it's really funny that the most high quality piece of data is, you know, ABC or XYZ.
Right. So having essentially, you know, kind of a process through pretty much most of the data that's out there in the internet, you can definitely find some things that make you kind of wonder about humanity itself and what it puts out there.
Sure.
There's absolutely, of course, the golden nuggets of knowledge in the form of textbooks and the scientific papers and the medical studies and the legal studies that are written essentially by the scholars and by people with high expertise. And of course, it's a pleasure to have the high quality aspects be included in the training of Granite.
So it's an aspect that we've talked about on the show before. And I think this is a great thing hearing you talk a little bit more about it is just, you know, this is not just a matter of kind of dumping huge amounts of data into the model. It is that, but there's just a lot of work that goes into like selecting the right tokens. It's almost, artisanal in nature, right? You're getting like the right, blend to get the best results out of the model.
Well, Tim, it's artisanal, but I also want to highlight something that the team did that I think is really cool, which is the degree of experimenting and searching that the team did over different data mixtures. So training one, 2 billion parameter model requires training. Petros, I don't know, how many small models do you think you trained?
Oh, we trained hundreds of those very easily.
No big deal.
Models, we trained thousands of those to get down to the proper mixtures, as well as kind of bigger models in the order of like 1 to 2 billion parameters. We trained literally hundreds of those in order to figure out what is the best type of cleansing and the best type of mixing, right? So definitely lots of effort by very large teams in IBM research. And lots of infrastructure thrown behind it, both GPUs as well as general clusters.
Yeah, for sure.
And to underscore some of the, like, it's not always black and white, right, on data. So some of the decisions and processes the team went through, like a fun example is just thinking about, how many emojis do you include in Granite training model data? So like, what is the appropriate level of emoji, Tim, for a model to understand?
That's a hard question. I mean, what's the risk of having too many emojis?
Well, then the model has a predilection to give a lot of emojis in the response, which, I mean, depending on your use case, maybe you care about that, but you certainly, in an enterprise setting, probably don't want to skew towards emojis. But if you remove emojis altogether, the model doesn't understand the concept of emojis, can't interpret emojis, which of course is going to be critical for a variety of just basic tasks and use cases. So, there was a whole effort, I'm not kidding, just figuring out what is the right level of emojis that the model should be trained on to understand.
That's fascinating. Right. Well, Kush, I don't want to let you off the hook here. I know, I understand you were also involved in this release. Do you want to talk a little bit about more of your part of this launch?
Yeah, I was involved in a few different parts, actually. So on the Granite 3.0, the language models, actually, as Kate said, it's really language and code and a lot of things all together. So I was involved in a lot of the safety alignment. These things, after Petros does his work, right, we have the pre-training data, then there's the training process, and then there's further alignment after that. Part of that is taking the model from the base model into an instruct model, but then after that, doing further tuning to make it safe in various ways. I was working with, again, a big team of folks, and we were coming up with seed examples to generate synthetic data across many different types of harms and risks, and kind of figuring out how to get the model not to engage in those topics. That's one key area. And I would just want to point out the way we evaluate that level of safety is through a variety of benchmarks. One of those was developed in our HiFi research lab. It's called ATTAC, A-T-T-A, with a Q at the end. And we actually compared the Granite 3.0, all of the models, but the 8 billion instruct as an example, outperforms all of the other competitors that are out there in this benchmark. It's really is the safest in many ways. And then that's one half. The other half of the work was on the Granite Guardian models. And so the way to think about it is when you're thinking about safety, about preventing harms, you want to do the best that you can on the main model. But then inherently that it's never going to be perfect. So there should also be a second model that's independent, that's actually checking the first model to make sure that It's not putting bad stuff out there. So the Granite Guardian is a second model. It's actually built on top of the Granite 3.0 language models. But it's kind of constrained just to give a yes or a no answer. So it'll say, look at either an input prompt at a model response or the combination, and it'll say yes or no. Is this harmful? Is it doing, is it a jailbreaking attack? Is there hallucination? Is there a problem with context relevance? Is there a problem with answer relevance in a RAG setting? So this model is meant to act in that capacity. And it's important to understand it's actually not limited to just working with the Granite models. So you can apply this with any model out there. So I know we're going to talk about other models later in the show. So you can use the Granite Guardian with any of those.
Yeah, for sure. There's a lot there. I mean, I guess maybe one question to kind of push you a little bit further, Kush, is one thing that occurs to me is like safety is so broad.
Yeah.
Right. Like there's only so many things that like a model could do wrong in the world.
Yeah.
How does you and your team kind of like work to kind of manage those risks, right? Because it's like this infinite attack space.
Yeah.
But as yet, you know, like tech exchanges this week, you got to get something launched. Curious about how you reconcile those two, how the team thinks about like broadening its risk set over time or narrowing it over time. I just think it's a really interesting process that a lot of people don't usually hear about.
Yeah, and it is always about broadening. So as you said, that attack surface area is pretty much infinite. So we can only pick and choose and touch on some parts of it. And we understand that. So we created this attack atlas. It's a paper. It'll be presented in Europe's in a workshop. And I mean, there's so many different ways, so many different strategies, so many different topics of harm. We can, I mean, just do our best, right? You keep making progress. You keep adding things. Using taxonomies to categorize different types of risks and harms. So building that up, trying to get as broad coverage as you can, looking at different strategies of those attacks, keep working on that. But it's a cat and mouse game in some sense. So kind of red teaming, blue teaming, going back and forth, kind of seeing what the problems are, then figuring out how to address them and just cycling through it. And yeah, I mean, again, nothing's ever going to be perfect. It's a process.
Yeah, for sure. So, Kate, you'll have to indulge me. I mean, as the lawyer on the phone, you were like, the most exciting thing is Apache. And I was like, yes, let's talk about Apache 2.0. why should our listeners be excited about that if they're not huge licensing nerds?
So I think the reason to be excited is Apache 2.0 is an incredibly permissive license. It basically says that anyone can take and use our Granite models and can customize them however you like. Use any outputs of the models however you like, and IBM will make no claims to that IP, and you have full rights. So that's really important for especially enterprises who are looking to customize models, large language models, with their own data, with their own IP. You want to make sure you have no further restrictions on what is essentially now your IP that you've encoded inside of a large language model. So we're really excited about being able to offer these models under those terms and make sure that they're just as reducing the barriers for the broader community to use them and customize them as much as possible. And it's something of a bit of a dying breed, unfortunately, if we look at models that are being released in the open. We are seeing models continue to be released in the open, but more and more they're being released with custom licenses. So we're trying to keep it simple. Apache 2, please take our models. Please customize them and go use them out in the world.
Yeah, I was definitely confronted with this recently. I was, you know, importing a model from Hugging Face recently, and I was like, oh, the model was gated. And then it was like a completely custom license. I was like, this is going to take forever to see if this is something I really want to work with. Can I ask why? Like, why is IBM taking the most open kind of perspective? It sounds like there's actually been a conscious strategy to say, we're going to be, out of all the open providers, the most open.
Well, again, I think it really comes down to this enterprise use case where we believe the future of large language models and generative AI in the enterprise is being able to customize models with enterprise and proprietary data. And so really we're trying to create the tools both through the base models, like the Granite model series, which can be then customized without any restrictions on its use, and tools like InstructLab, which is through our RHEL AI product offering at Red Hat. You can take those models and customize them and build on top of them without concerns or worry. And then wrapping that all right under, if you get our models through, for example, WatsonX AI, through indemnification and other protections support. So it's really trying to make sure that we create this kind of open market and ecosystem that our customers can build on with confidence.
Yeah. And I think that's actually a theme I really wanted to build on, just because, I mean, a big part of this seems to be like unleash the developers to kind of do what they need to do around these models. And we're not going to kind of put any controls over that. But one kind of unique thing, and I guess Petros, maybe you're the natural person to bring into this discussion, is IBM, as I understand it, is also open sourcing the kind of data prep kit around these models, which is kind of a unique thing, right? Like, I think there's been a lot of hype around open sourced models, but like what seems to be here is also like a level of openness around all of the stuff that goes into constructing the model. I guess there's kind of two questions for you. One of them is why? Like, why is IBM doing that? But let's maybe start there. And there's a kind of follow-up I would love to ask you.
Sure. Yeah, that goes along the general theme of openness. We're not opening the models themselves and their weights under the, if I may say it in a single sentence, the most permissive license, right? That's what Apache 2.0 is. We're similarly doing the same thing with the software assets that we developed. We open source them again under the Apache 2.0 license, the most permissive one. Both to enable the community to build upon that, be able to reproduce it, be able to make use of the same, in some sense, kind of facilities that we developed and used for the training of Granite. We believe that this benefits the overall community, the overall ecosystem. And, you know, as Kate said, it enables more and more developers, essentially, to follow the same kind of best practices that we learned through hard lessons, if I may say.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, like, you guys have solved the emoji question so that developers don't have
to. We debated a lot around the emoji question. That is
Exactly. Yeah, I can tell this. I can only imagine the meetings, and it's incredible.
Exactly.
That's really great. I guess the follow-up question around kind of this sort of the data prep kit and open sourcing it as well is, you know, I'm curious if you think that this is also a way of kind of encouraging other providers to also start releasing their data openly, right? Because I think this is like such an important aspect of the ecosystem. And I've been also frustrated at times, right? Like a new model will come out and it behaves totally differently and breaks all of your tooling. And you're like, why is that? And I would love to be able to kind of delve a little bit further. And so the hope is like that what IBM's doing here becomes a more general practice. And I guess kind of Petros, I'm curious if you think like if you're hearing from around the industry, like I would love to see this become more of a norm, but I'm curious if you think it's going to become one.
Right. Yeah. No, that's a very good question. So yeah, there's kind of an interesting adage that goes like, you know, every conversation in AI starts with models, but ends with data, right? Meaning that everyone recognizes that data is the kind of oil or the fuel that powers the AI models. So open sourcing this is, you know, the data prep kit is a kind of a good practice. Bring on more people and developers into doing the same. There is a trend developing around essentially providing the data assets for preparing models. NVIDIA, for example, has its own Nemo Curator. Other kind of big names as well are going towards that direction, along with the general kind of theme of openness that IBM is advocating for. Data is essentially the natural thing that follows.
Yeah, for sure. Well, I want to throw it open before we move on to our next topic. I mean, obviously, there were lots of things announced at Tech Exchange. We've been talking a lot about Granite because, well, you all have just spent a lot of time working on Granite. Are there other things that you'd point people towards that they should, you know, check out while they're kind of looking at this stuff online? I'm curious if, you know, I know there's a code assistant announced, but also just like I was looking at the list and I was like, there's way more things that happened here than we'll have time to cover. But I'm kind of curious if there's like, you know, specific things that you'd highlight that we should kind of shout out here.
I might just give a couple of shout outs. One, please go and try out the models, especially on platforms like, we're really excited, Ollama. You can run these models locally. They're blazing fast. Really excited that we're making these models broadly available across a number of different partners. Second, there was a big focus at Tech Exchange on agents and assistants. So really excited to see how the WatsonX software portfolio is continuing to evolve and create different agent orchestrators and management of agentic systems. So I think you're going to continue to see a lot of really exciting work from IBM in that space.
Yeah, for sure. And maybe we'll end with you, Kush, is, you know, where is Granite going next? I guess there's kind of a question when we're sitting here in 2025 mm-hmm. talking about what just happened in Tech Exchange. I'm kind of curious about like what the team is piling towards and particularly mm-hmm. in safety. I know what you mm-hmm. work on. Like if there's kind of like what's the next frontier on safety, I think would be great for people to hear about.
Yeah, so I mean, one thing, just building on what Petro said, having this data prep kit out there is not only a boon for, the value creation among the developers and the ecosystem, but it is also contributing to the safety aspects. Because when you can inspect these things, then you can know, this is why this is happening and these are potential concerns as well. So I think just the movement towards openness is going to be a big aspect of the safety world. At Tech Exchange, we announced some new features in what's next.governance as well. That's our platform play on the governance and safety side. But where Granite goes next, with the Granite Guardian, especially, as Kate said, with the agentic workflows. Our next release of Granite Guardian will have function calling hallucination detection. So that's something that's not out there from anyone else. And I think that'll bridge the gap. So when you are talking to a model in natural language and then it translates that into an API call, we want to make sure that there's nothing wrong happening in that step. So if the parameters or the function names or the parameter values, all of those should come out cleanly. So that's one of the more exciting sort of things that we have lined up.
Well, awesome. A lot more to potentially talk about, but this is a great overview. And I'm glad we kind of got a little behind the scenes on how these launches happen, because there's just, you know, you just see the model at the end of the day, but it's just like, it turns out like lots of humans spend a lot of time just getting that right. So appreciate you giving our listeners a little bit of a lead in. So our next story that we really want to focus on is some news that kind of came out this week about the company Perplexity. So if you're not familiar, Perplexity is essentially AI-driven search. It's a little bit different from, you know, what you kind of get from like a traditional Google experience where, you know, you have a search bar. Instead, it's kind of you ask queries and you can kind of make it interactive. You have a conversation and it pulls results from the internet. The big news was that the rumors were that the company was about to raise $500 million at an $8 billion valuation, which I believe is twice what it was before. And that's just wild. Obviously, we're living through an era of like a lot of excitement around AI, and AI company valuations are sort of through the roof. But even I saw this number and I was like, wow, this is really intense. And I guess, Kate, maybe I'll kick it to you. Is this valuation justified? Like, what is chat the future of search? Like, is this the new Google that we're looking at? Or kind of curious about how you size up news that a company like this would be valued at this value.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a lot going on, as you say, certainly a lot of hype. But yes, I think chat is the future of search. I think it's just a much more natural way to try and find information to inquire about something. But I also really wonder, you know, how differentiated or competitive Perplexity can stay, right? What's their moat, you know, to prevent others from basically doing the same thing with a different API end call. So, you know, I do worry that we're seeing some inflation here of expectations and in this valuation.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, not for nothing. I mean, out of all of the subscriptions that I'm spending on monthly, Perplexity is one of the few that I actually use regularly, but okay, I think you're touching on a super important question, which is what is the moat? Is there a moat here? I mean, Petros, I'm curious if you have any views on, like, it seems like maybe other search companies that I could name might be really good at this, doing this at some point.
But
I mean, clearly someone sees something in this. Like, they feel like it's a good enough bet. And so I guess I don't know if you want to give us like the kind of bull case, right? Like, is there a moat here?
Right. I have to admit, I agree with Kate. I'm also struggling mm-hmm. to figure out what the moat is in this case. Mm-hmm. Search, unsurprisingly, has been one of the areas that many companies, both startups as well as like big mega corporations, actually have tried to tackle and attack essentially the incumbents, right, over the years. It never panned out. Well, why? Because, you know, the existing ones were good enough, right? They were pretty good. Now it's a brand new interface, essentially, a brand new way of interacting with the search engine. More importantly, getting something that I feel everyone appreciates, a very good summary of things, instead of having like to go and read yourself. Everyone really appreciates someone to summarize in a nice executive kind of bulleted point type of interface. So that being said, kind of the valuation on this kind of type of expectations probably is kind of makes sense. The moat, I'm also struggling to figure out what it is, especially as a few big names out there that we are all aware of are essentially on it, right?
Yeah, for sure. Kush, there's one question I really wanted to bring up around safety. So I agree. I mean, I think like interacting with Perplexity, I'm like, oh yeah, like chat really is like giving me a lot of action on search. Unfortunately, I think one of the things that it's caused me to do the most of recently is like buy too many books, because I'm always like, oh, could you give me some recommendations? It's like, oh, of course. And here's like 10 fascinating books about the thing that you're interested in. Maybe I play skeptic for a moment. Yeah. I do think that one of the really funny things about LLMs is that everybody has rushed to use it as a search interface. But like out of the box, LLMs are not concerned with information retrieval. They're not really concerned about facts. They're not really concerned about, you know, validation or verification. There's no notion of like a page rank that would even give kind of like, you know, a sense of credibility between different sources. So, you know, there's almost, if I can play skeptic for a moment, I'd love to hear kind of the counter argument is, no, you know, LLMs are not the future of search, because like LLMs do something that's just so fundamentally different from what you want out of search that like it's weird that we're in this weird situation. We've got this technology. We're trying to like bolt search like features onto this tech. Isn't that a little bit like getting, you know, the cart before the horse?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I think you're absolutely right in many ways, right? So the fact is really it's the RAG that's doing the search, right? And then the language model is like on top of it, I mean, creating the bullet points or whatever have you. So, and like, I'll disagree with Kate a little bit. I'm not convinced the chat is the best method for doing search necessarily, or the best interface, because like when I go and I'm like searching for stuff, like a research assistant goes to the library and like is actually like trying to find stuff. The chat isn't like all of the way there, right? I mean, I think there's like, oh, you go down one rabbit hole, oh, you come back, you look for this, you go over here, go do this and that. So it's not a linear process, which is what chat kind of insists on. And so intent-based interaction is certainly part of it. So chat is, I think, the simplest version of kind of intent communication. But I think there's more ways of doing this that are going to actually emerge and that are more helpful. So that's where the LLM strength will be, like kind of how to organize the work, organize these sort of different threads and putting them together. The search itself, I think, is the retrieval part, and that is actually already not part of how the LLM is doing it. So I think that's where we might end up going.
Yeah, that's super helpful. I mean, as almost like, it's almost two innovations really that we're talking about, right? Like one is the actual retrieval, and then almost like the LLM is just like the spice on top that makes it, you know, more digestible. I don't know, Kate, if you want to kind of respond to that at all.
No, I mean, I don't disagree. I think chat is a huge improvement on search compared to just, you know, shouting into the void of a search box. But is it the final frontier? You know, I definitely think, because you bring up some really good points, you know, this isn't quite a linear flow. And, you know, a lot of ways I think we've worked on making a faster horse when we need a car, right? Is the kind of old saying, we've made chat a really fast horse, but what does a car invention look like in the search world? So, you know, certainly there's opportunities ahead.
Yeah, it'd be cool if it's like an entirely different paradigm. Like in some ways, I do think about the kind of anchoring effect of stuff like ChatGPT is like the only reason we've taken this interface is because there was this accidental thing where this particular product became so successful that we kind of see everything about LLMs through this lens. But it's like, it's just almost like a historical accident in some ways.
It's really interesting to think about kind of the different users. Like Kush, as a researcher, you know, you probably have a very well-honed art to how you investigate with utmost rigor on different topics, where, you know, if we talk about somebody who's just trying to, you know, find, you know, what grocery store is closest or, you know, more casual investigation, you know, that's probably a different mode. So I think there's tremendous diversity as well in potential interfaces that we're going to see for search. And there's probably not going to be one size fits all.
Yeah, no, I would definitely agree with that. I mean, when my kids are looking for information, like how many goals did like Alex Morgan score throughout her career? I mean, they don't need to do it in the same rigorous way as I need to do my research. So yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, and I think my long-term theory is that a little bit like how there's like Google Ease, where people have just like not, they don't really speak in English is kind of like a string of words that they found to optimize the search result. Like we will also end up having like a very, even for these chat interfaces, like our own perplexity ease, which will like not be quite a conversation, but will just be like how we've kind of learned to get the best results out of the system.
Well, and ironically, as we do that, the model providers are going to be figuring out how to take that Google Ease version, translate it into what they think is optimal for the model,
right.
And then feed that. So there's just going to be layers and layers of trying to find the right way to frame a question.
And that is what agentic workflows are. I mean, I think multiple layers of agents translating from one thing to another thing to another thing. So, I mean, that's where we're headed.
All right, for our final story, it's another open source model story, but I think it's another interesting one to kind of compare and contrast and kind of like talk about the overall trend in open source. NVIDIA, maker of Fine GPUs, has come out recently with a fine tune of Llama that they call Nemotron, specifically Nemotron 70B Instruct. It was kind of widely touted by NVIDIA. They showed that they were able to beat a bunch of state-of-the-art benchmarks across all the other proprietary models. I think that's all well and interesting. But I think one thing I wanted to bring to this panel was just to ask the question of why. I know NVIDIA from its GPUs, its hardware. Like, why are they getting into the model training business? And why would they be open sourcing models at all? Petros, I'm kind of curious. Maybe we'll just throw it to you.
Yeah, that's a very interesting question. Everyone knows NVIDIA about its GPUs. I'm not sure how many people will know that NVIDIA's moat is actually, in my view, software. It's actually the CUDA interfaces and drivers that essentially have managed to attract developers over the course of the last 10 years onto the NVIDIA hardware. That's why everyone actually ended up using NVIDIA and still using GPUs from NVIDIA. So in that sense, they do have a very kind of strong moat in the form of software. So it's only kind of natural to expect them to expand on that, both in terms of the software ecosystem that they build around their hardware, as well as, of course, showcasing this through models that are able to train themselves. And the last kind of thought on this from my side is the fact that NVIDIA is also developing its NVIDIA Cloud, which is also another kind of aspect that contributes to the ecosystem of AI models that NVIDIA essentially is driving for sure from the hardware side.
So I guess, I mean, Kate, this sounds like, I guess, from Petros' interpretation, that's almost like just it's a show of strength. Like NVIDIA is just saying, we can do models like this. But I guess part of this is like they're trying to attract people to their cloud, right? Like I guess part of this is marketing the cloud offering, which it's true. When I think of cloud, I think of, you know, Google, I think of Amazon. I don't really think of NVIDIA. Is that kind of how you read it as well? That it's sort of kind of like trying to promote that aspect of their business?
Yeah, you know, I think it's really a powerful demonstration, right, of being able to say we can take a model and we can customize it, we can continue to train it, and we can continue to boost performance beyond, in NVIDIA's terms, what was originally released in the instruct version of the 70 billion Llama model. But so in doing so, I think they're trying to demonstrate, right, that they have these capabilities and invite customers to come and join in and be able to customize their own models, continue to train their own models all on NVIDIA's platform. So it makes a lot of sense just as a pure almost marketing point, right, being able to showcase their capabilities.
Yeah, definitely. Kush, do you think this makes the other companies a little bit nervous? I'm kind of thinking about like, you know, like NVIDIA has always been like in the background, the chip people, they do infrastructure. And then now this is almost like, what, you're on our turf, right? Like, what are you doing releasing something that competes with O1 or, you know, Opus or whatever? Should the companies be nervous? Like, is this kind of NVIDIA kind of playing in a new playground in some ways?
Yeah, I think so. And I mean, I think in the future, what'll happen is like, just like in with traditional machine learning, we we have a problem, we would look for a data set or collect a data set and then go and build a model for that. I think now in a couple of years, it's going to be where models are the same. You have a problem, you go look for a model that's appropriate, you go look for maybe some fine-tuning data that's appropriate, and then you work with those. You're not going to treat models as anything other than artifacts that are part of the world of possibilities for solving your problem. And so I think the way that NVIDIA can kind of position themselves is that now all these models are out there. Whatever company, you don't have to like innovate on those pre-trained models. But what you do need to do is the customization. And I mean, that's the WatsonX story as well. But the customization, come to us. I mean, we're going to be the ones who help you. And I think just having that mindset available that you don't have to worry about all of these different models and just on the customization, I think that's the part that'll kind of be their strength. Another thing I'll kind of just say is, there's this overused trope. I mean, that in the gold rush, the people that made money were the ones who provided the shovels or whatever, or the blue jeans. So I think with the blue jeans, I think the thing is, I mean, they somehow crossed over from just being something for miners to being like a high fashion sort of item people would customize and so forth. So I think it's, I mean, somehow moving from that commodity to the fashion as well in some capacity.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, it's the it's the high prestige, couture, you know, models, salvaged denim, right, jeans. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, I think that final comment is so interesting too, because it kind of suggests the ways in which, I guess, some of these visions are aligned, particularly between, like, say, IBM and NVIDIA, where sort of NVIDIA is like, well, so long as there's more demand for models, we're excited because it all takes place on chips, right? And then IBM in some ways is like, we want to release all these models to kind of unleash all these developers, but we also believe there's going to be like a lot of enterprise services we'll do on top of it. And I actually even understand, is it right? I think Granite's going to be available on NVIDIA as well.
It is. They were a launch partner. You can check out the Granite 3.0 models on NVIDIA today.
And even the Granite Guardian, within 12 hours, they had it up as a full working demo. So you can try the Granite Guardian there too.
Yeah, it's so fast. Well, great. Well, that's all the time we have for today. Kate, Kush, always great to see you. Thanks for taking the time to talk about Granite. And Petros, hope we have you on the show again in the future.
Thank you very much for having me. Hope so too.
Well, listeners, if you enjoyed what you heard, you can get us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and podcast platforms everywhere. And we'll see you next week for another action-packed week of Mixture of Experts.